You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe C.J. Alvarez. He's a professor of Mexican-American and Latino-Latina studies at the University of Texas, Austin, and he is spending the year here at the School for Advanced Research. He's author of the new book, Borderland, Border Water, A History of Construction on the U.S.-Mexico Divide. Welcome, CJ.
Glad to be here.
And you will be also speaking at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe, on Saturday, the 21st of December at 5:30, along with historian Eric Paramond and artist Scott Johnson. And that's an event called Mapping, which you maybe you can tell us about that a little bit later on in the program, because I'm curious to hear what that's about. But first, let's talk about your book, which is about the border between the U.S. and Mexico. And when we talk about the border between these two countries, it's not just a line. I mean, as you point out in the book, it's a whole history of political boundaries and also attitudes toward the land. How was this border between the U.S. and Mexico drawn in the first place?
Well, it was a product originally of the U.S. invasion of Mexico in 1846. The United States attacks Mexico. It was the Mexican-American War was one of the most controversial and unpopular wars in American history, which people have a tendency to forget. It was resolved relatively quickly, militarily. And one of the outcomes was the Mexican cession, that is, half of Mexican territory was taken by the United States and forms most of the U.S. West as we know it today.
Where we're sitting, for example.
Where we're sitting, yeah, here in Santa Fe. And where I teach in Texas, and so on and so forth, all the way out to California and even beyond. So the question was then, in the minds of the treaty makers, well, okay, we decided that there's going to be this transfer of territory, but where are we going to actually put the border? They decided on the southern border of Texas just to use the Rio Grande, which the Mexicans call Rio Bravo, as just a natural border, which at the time made sense. It would turn out in the 20th century that using a moving river as an international border was probably a bad idea. But nevertheless, they decided on the Rio Grande. And then they largely arbitrarily drew this proverbial line in the sand for the western boundary that goes from just south of San Antonio to El Paso, Texas. And that in many ways was a much more arbitrary decision, and it was made by people who had never been to that part of the world before. And this, to me, is a really important way of starting this border story I'm trying to tell, because it's an early example of what would come to be a really common feature in border history, and that is federal officials making border policy without knowing anything about the actual border region.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about the border, is that people who are not from this area, not from the Southwest, not from the borderlands, have a couple of different common perspectives. And one of them is the perspective of, you know, this is a bleak and barren wasteland and it's dangerous and sinister. And then the other one is it's beautiful and romantic and it's sort of like scenery. And then there's the people who actually live there who have their own perspective.
You know, you just actually summed up the main argument of the book I'm working on here, which is about the history of the Chihuahuan Desert. And that's exactly the kind of historical narrative that, to a certain extent in Borderland, Border Water, but more so in my new work that I'm trying to push back against, is the telling of border stories and desert stories from the point of view of outsiders. I'm really interested in capturing border perspectives and desert perspectives that, like you said, are almost never in sync with either the big wasteland narrative or the beautiful desert narrative.
What are some examples of how people who come from this area see themselves and see their land? I mean, part of the problem is, and we can talk about this with respect to your book, this whole idea that civilization involves exploiting the living heck out of the land, and that the people there are savages who don't understand that, who might be making the sort of ridiculous and old-fashioned mistake of actually trying to live in harmony with their land.
Well, there's a couple of answers to that question. One's a political answer, one's more of an environmental answer. Speaking to the political question, I mean, I could draw on my own experience growing up in Las Cruces in southern New Mexico. You know, my dad's side, we go back four generations, and we originally come from Mexico. So on paper, it would look like, oh, these are border people, they're Mexican-American, they're implicated in this political divide. But in fact, you know, I mean, the fact that we were in such close proximity to the border made very little difference in our day-to-day lives. And so my point is that I think oftentimes when people in the broader conversation and debate think about the U.S.-Mexico border, they're thinking about immigration policy and long-distance migrants moving from somewhere in Central America or even beyond, or in Central Mexico to some place in L.A. or Chicago, etc. And for a lot of border residents and border people, we've been there for a very long time. So long, in fact, the political import of the border today doesn't really have much of an effect on our day-to-day lives. And then from an environmental point of view, the people who came out and drew that border, that line in the sand in the 19th century, their environmental point of view, for the most part, or point of reference, was temperate zone forests, whether that's the eastern part of the United States or whether that's the central highlands of Mexico. Even though it's not temperate, it's high altitude enough to be temperate, even though it's technically in the tropics. And so both the Mexican officials that came up to the arid north and the American officials who came out to the arid west and met there on that western borderline were all pretty horrified by the desert and by this place that they had very strong cultural associations with savagery and barbarism. Like, if you were in a terrible environment, as they saw it, and you actually lived there, you were from there, whether you were indigenous or whether you were one of the rural Mexicans who lived up there, then you, by extension, were terrible and were suspect just by virtue of being a desert person. So that, I think, is another way of thinking about why the U.S.-Mexico border region has had such a bad reputation throughout its history and why it's been so controversial, is I think there's an environmental story tied up in that.
Well, as you say, I mean, the environmental story, part of it is that the Rio Grande is a river that, like many rivers, is not a static. You know, it's not like a pipeline that goes from point A to point B. It meanders. It can even change course a little bit here and there. It's got a floodplain. And those things were considered, disorderly or something, to the point where they moved the river, channelized the river, straightened the river with really dire environmental consequences.
Catastrophic environmental consequences. And this, I find, what you're talking about, this big river straightening project, happened around El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. And the way I think about that part of the border and that part of the river is as follows. The Rio Grande is fascinating because it starts here in the headwaters of like the southern Rockies. So not in the desert, right? In Colorado and all these tributaries running out of the Jemez Range and the Sangre de Cristos here in Santa Fe. Then it enters the desert around Socorro. And then once you get down toward the Delta, you know, down when you get into the South Texas towns, it turns into this subtropical wetlands, and it's not in the desert anymore. And so this river passes through the desert. It's right where it's in the middle of the desert that they decided to start the U.S.-Mexico border at El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. Why is this important? Because desert rivers, more than temperate zone rivers, have a tendency to move because they're running very shallowly through disarticulated sand, alluvium. So they build up these sandbanks, and then the river jumps course. Fine. That's what rivers do. Unless you're trying to make a river be a political boundary as well. And of course, political boundaries are not supposed to move. And the farther along you get in U.S.-Mexico border history up until the present day, the more important it is to make sure that those borders don't move and that they are very fixed and very easily identifiable. So from that point of view, the river is the worst decision you could have made imaginable, to a desert river, to make this international border. But the way they solved that over the course of multiple building projects, as you mentioned, is to try to lock this desert river down through straightening, through concrete channelization, and so forth. It's a pretty dramatic transformation of a river.
And so what have been the consequences of that, both sort of in the early 20th century and when they started those projects and up to the present?
Well, there have been diplomatic consequences for sure. This section of river between El Paso and Juarez moved in the 19th century after a big flash flood that all desert people are familiar with, like the damage that a flash flood can do. This flood accidentally cedes territory, about 600 acres total, I think, to the United States. Of course, it was, you know, after Mexico had lost half of its territory, they were sensitive about any amount of land that was ceded to the United States, and this happened through this movement of the Desert River. And so there was a back and forth for decades and decades and decades between Mexican presidents and American presidents to try to sort this out. Finally was in the 1960s. But it created a lot of diplomatic tension between the two countries. And then environmentally, it essentially killed the river.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing left.
Well, they shortened it so much, too.
Yeah, they cut all the bends. It used to be winding. It used to be meandering.
Right.
So it has kind of a serpentine look to it if you look at the old maps. And they cut those bends out and straightened it and built levees on the outside. And what I think is so interesting about, and what I'm trying to do in the book, to bring these water engineering stories into the fore and remind people of just how dramatically transformed these environments have been. If you grow up around the river after the cottonwoods had been ripped out, after the channel had been encased in concrete, after the meanders had been cut out and it had been straightened, basically when it had been turned into an industrial drain between El Paso and Juarez and just kind of an agricultural irrigation ditch, if that's all you know,
it's normal.
It's normal.
Yeah.
And you don't remember what it was like before. So you think that's what a river is. You think that's what a border is. And part of what I'm trying to do is to remind people, no, not necessarily.
Well, I mean, rivers need to meander in order to be healthy and to support all the aquatic life and terrestrial life around them.
Exactly. There was this fascinating, when I was doing the research, I became interested in what other rivers around the country, around the world, have been straightened? That seems like a very dramatic thing to do, straighten a river that was actually meandering. And I found an example in the wetlands of Florida. I think I'm pronouncing this right, the Kissimmee River, that was turned into a big canal, basically. They didn't even call it a river, they called it Canal 39, after they straightened it. And there was a movement relatively recently to re-bend it, to put the bends back in and turn it into a more natural river that it had once been. And as I was reading about this, it stood in such stark contrast in my mind to what happened around El Paso and Juarez, because that's unthinkable.
Right.
It's unthinkable nowadays to even imagine the fence that's very new to come down, let alone to re-bend this desert river. It's unimaginable.
And that channelization and straightening and basically industrialization of the landscape bespeaks this whole mentality that basically coincided with the creation of the U.S.-Mexico border, which is this industrial extractive mentality. And the idea is, whether it be mining or cattle ranching or oil, you take that land or other kinds of, you know, irrigated agriculture. You take that land, you extract as much value as you possibly can from it, and the consequences to the land or the sustainability are not even considerations.
Yeah, not even close. And I think that in the earlier days, the 19th century, when you look at extractivist industries, and when you look at whether you're talking about oil or copper or silver, zinc, take your pick, I think, you know, this is before we had the climate data that we have today. This is before we fully understood the environmental implications of resource extraction in an unsustainable way, resource exploitation, which, of course, these industries were always terrible for workers.
Which is another kind of extraction of value, if you really...
Which I always say this to my students, that if you think about environmental exploitation and labor exploitation, it's kind of two sides of the same coin. You can't really have one without the other. They're often very closely linked. And I think that these mining industries and these agricultural, these non-sustainable agricultural industries in these very fragile lands of the deserts at the border are perfect examples of that.
Some of the projects that have happened on the border that you write about in your book were held up as kind of beautiful examples of Mexican-American cooperation, international cooperation, and isn't it lovely? How much of that was real? How much of that was PR? Describe some of these projects and, you know, whose impetus it really was to build them.
Well, I think the two main projects that stand out is the projects that were heralded as great examples of U.S.-Mexico collaboration are these two gigantic storage dams that actually straddle the international divide. There's Amistad Dam that's around Del Rio, Texas, and then there's Falcon Dam, which is farther south. So these are on the main stem of the Rio Grande. Half the dams are in the United States, half the dams are in Mexico. Half the workers were American, half the workers were Mexican. Half the engineers were American, half the engineers were Mexican. They were, in fact, some of the most bilateral projects that we've ever done with Mexico. And those dams were put in primarily for flood control, which was always a very serious issue on all parts of the Rio Grande. But as the border towns became more and more populated, and as industry and agriculture became more and more built out, it became more of a perceived threat, precisely because there was more money at stake, there were more lives at stake, etc. So,
I mean, really, the river by itself didn't pose a problem unless people wanted to encroach on the floodplain.
Exactly. I mean, the way I always put it is, there's really no such thing as a flood unless you're thinking about it from a human point of view. Because rivers, they overflow all the time, they move all the time. That's what rivers do. It only becomes a problem if you have human settlement that's very close to it.
But meanwhile, these big sort of bilateral projects, and were they really to the benefit of both countries? I mean, did they do what the hype sort of said they were doing?
You know, I think they did. I think that one of the things that's so interesting to me about the river projects, as opposed to the land projects, which is mainly fencing and barriers and that sort of thing, the river projects really complicate this idea that we have about U.S.-Mexico relations that's usually framed in terms of antagonism and in terms of tension between the two countries. And these hydraulic engineering projects are, I think, pretty good examples of genuinely collaborative, genuinely mutually beneficial kinds of construction projects, in contrast to the land border, which is much more unilateral from the United States point of view.
Meanwhile, there's these other projects, which are border fences. Talk about the first border fences, what they were for, and how this sort of, you know, going from like a wooden fence to chain link fences to walls to these giant mammoths we have now. That's basically a kind of political history all of its own.
Yeah. I discovered the first long distance border fence was built between 1939 and 1951, but most of it was built between 1947 and 1951 after the war ended. This fence was over 200 miles long, all on the western land border, of course. And when I say I discovered it, I mean that I came across in the National Archives branch in Fort Worth. They have all the documents from the International Boundary and Water Commission. And so I just opened these boxes that had never been opened by researchers before. And I'm pulling out blueprints and maps and documents that, as far as I can tell, no one outside the Boundary Commission had ever seen. One of which was this very detailed map that I reproduced in the book of where exactly that early border fence was over the course of over 200 miles.
Now, 200 miles in what states? Arizona?
200 miles in Southern California, Arizona, and New Mexico.
Okay.
And the reason that the fence was there, for the most part, and the reason there was this big boom after 1947 was not just because World War II ended and there was more domestic attention being paid to, or there's more attention being paid to domestic issues, but because there was a huge outbreak of foot and mouth disease in Mexico. So
So it was a cattle fence.
It was a cattle fence. We're talking about a barbed wire fence. We're not talking about nationalist fortification. We're not talking about a big immigration policing project. We're talking about essentially a fence that worked from their point of view. This foot and mouth disease epizootic did not spill over the border, in large part because of a quarantine in central Mexico, but also because of this border fence. Now, the big difference between that early long-distance border fence and the big border barriers that we started to see being built from the 1990s on is that this early fence was the site of where that fencing was supposed to go was determined by people from the Bureau of Animal Industry. In other words, they're like, we know where the ranches are, we know where these corridors are, we know where the cattlemen are on the Mexican side, so here's where we need the fence. It was very locally tailored.
So that's an example of people who actually know the area.
Exactly.
Working on the... Yeah.
Exactly. Whereas the border fences, you know, of today, it goes all the way back to what we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, and that is people in Washington who have no idea, who have no local frame of reference, and who are coming up with border fencing ideas from the political branches, not from the Agriculture Bureau.
So this was all about cattle at a certain point, but you also write about the Mexican Revolution and that kind of early first, what would you call it, first example of kind of militarization of the border.
Yeah, that's really, I think, the only example of an actual militarization of the border. We talk about the borders militarized today as a way of criticizing the buildup of the U.S. Border Patrol and the kinds of hardware they use and the tactical formations they use. But in fact, literally speaking, the only time the U.S.-Mexico border has been militarized on the U.S. side was during the 1910s as the Mexican Revolution was being fought. And at its height in 1917, Wilson had deployed 160,000 men-at-arms to the U.S.-Mexico border to do these very remote patrols, which dwarfs the size of the Border Patrol today, which is already the biggest civil law enforcement agency in American history. So, you know, it reconfigures how we think about what are we talking about when we talk about militarization and what is the deeper history of border patrolling and border policing.
So what was that Border Patrol doing at the time, and what happened after the revolution was over and sort of some semblance of stability began in Mexico?
So I think it's easy to think of that big deployment to the border in the 1910s as a very traditional kind of border guarding that you would see in, you know, historically in Europe. It's like, well, you know, France going to war with Germany, and so you guard the border. It wasn't like that. There wasn't any real concern that Mexico, like somehow the Mexican Revolution was going to become a military problem in the United States, in U.S. territory. The issue was largely how the Americans wanted to protect American interests in Mexico. So getting back to your point about extractivist industries, you know, large-scale ranching and that sort of thing, huge percentage, especially in northern Mexico in those years, of land and resources was owned and operated by Americans, which was in some ways part of the impetus that sparked the Mexican Revolution to begin with. One of the battle cries was Mexico for the Mexicans. There were so many foreigners making so much money off Mexican resources. And so the military deployment was really there in large part to enforce neutrality laws, to make sure that basically arms dealers in the American Southwest were not supplying munitions to the quote-unquote wrong faction in the Mexican conflict. And by wrong faction, I mean the people who were espousing more redistributive, like what we might call socialist policies, which of course were antithetical to American interests.
Well, and this is one of the things that I think is important, is you've got this very extractive kind of agriculture that is not good for the land, but creates large amounts of wealth as quickly as possible. You've often got things that really probably shouldn't be grown in the desert, being grown in the desert through massive irrigation projects, and that really stands in contrast to the traditional Mexican ejido system, which is a very much of a kind of communal and subsistence land practice.
Yeah, this is another, I don't write about this much in the book, but I think a lot about it. I mean, the big, really large-scale dryland irrigation technology starts in around the 1920s and beyond, so after the revolution is over. But if you look at those big projects, you can actually see a great similarity between the U.S. side and the Mexico side in terms of how wealth is accumulated and concentrated among the very few people who actually can control these big irrigation systems. So you find this in Delicias, in Chihuahua, you find it in the Imperial Valley in Southern California. You find smaller versions of it in the Mesilla Valley down in Southern New Mexico. But basically, you know, agriculture that relies pretty much exclusively on either groundwater pumping or river water diversion. And that then results in social stratification.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We'll be back in just a half a minute. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Elevating interest and opportunities in STEM, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks the Lanl Foundation for their sponsorship of this show. So we've got this borderland with a whole lot of history. You have the Mexican Revolution and the issues that you were just talking about. Then after World War II, you've got these, that's when the cattle barriers were, basically. Then you have a period that you describe in your book in the 1960s where it was like, well, we don't need these watchtowers. Let's take them down. You know, we don't really have a problem with Mexico. Let's all sort of hold hands and, you know, be friends. And then you started seeing, what was it, anti-Mexican sentiment? Was it drugs? Was it trade? Was it this, you know, what we now, this battle against so-called illegal immigration? What happened?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, the question that a lot of people are really interested in, what I think you're asking is, like, so when did today's border, like the border we think of today that's just incredibly contentious and that is overwhelmingly defined by unauthorized migration, policing, and black markets, contraband. Like, when did that start? Like, when did that become the least common denominator for understanding the border? And I think you're exactly right. I think it's in the 1960s. The immigration question and the psychoactive substances question are separate. Speaking only to the drug question, I think the big turning point was in 1969. As you said, the beginning of the 60s, it's like, you know, it was during the 60s that they resolved this big boundary dispute about that flood in El Paso and Juarez. Fantastic. We resolved that. That was the decade when they built Amistad Dam. And of course, Amistad in Spanish means friendship. And look at this. We're collaborating. The watchtowers came down. Maybe we're going to be these democratic neighbors that many people had always hoped that we could be. And then President Nixon in 1969 begins this policing initiative that he called Operation Intercept. And the idea was, we're going to inspect every single person and every single automobile that crosses every single port on the U.S.-Mexico divide.
Oh, that should be easy and and not time-consuming.
Well, it was disastrous. It was absolutely disastrous. And it broke with this tradition of bilateralism that we talked about with the dam, we talked about with the river straightening.
But was this all war on drugs, basically?
This was Nixon was actually the person who coined the phrase the war on drugs. There had been previous iterations of narcotic policing in China, like the 1950s, that also had geopolitical implications. But this idea of the war on drugs came from the Nixon administration. And he was the one, actually, in 1973 that created the DEA, which was actually a consolidation of multiple drug enforcement agencies. And he was the first person to really point at Mexico and use the border as a stand-in for, as like a scapegoat for American consumption of psychoactive substances, banned right. psychoactive substances.
Well, and which led off decade after decade after decade of trying to control the supply instead of the demand.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, there we saw a previous version of this during Prohibition, because, of course, during Prohibition in the 1920s, alcohol was criminalized in the U.S., but not in Mexico. And so you got a similar kind of dynamic of people running alcohol across the border. But there was a glamour to it. I mean, famous, like, movie stars and Amelia Earhart. And, I mean, people you read about in your high school, you know, textbooks were in Tijuana. They were in Ciudad Juarez. They were in these border towns at the speakeasies and sort of participating in this glamorous life in the absence of alcohol in the United States. Now, that glamour has completely gone away, and it has been replaced with a very tawdry narrative of, like, vice tourism on the Mexican side. And I think that's partly a result of this kind of federal policy that takes a very complex issue that involves an entire hemisphere of production, distribution, consumption, and reduces it to just the border.
Right. Which is still going on in this whole border wall thing. And what you have is this real complexity of realities, which is that, yeah, you've got drugs flowing north. You also have guns flowing south. You have a robust trade relationship. You have a labor market in the United States, which absolutely needs Mexican workers. And then you have this sort of politicized rhetoric about illegal immigration. And I've never had anybody be able to explain what the harm is, like what it is that people are actually worried about in the presence, I mean, when you actually look at the labor market.
Yeah. So we were just talking about the drug question. The immigration question is quite complex, because the United States has a different immigration relationship with Mexico than it does with Central American countries. Precisely because we had this huge guest worker program with Mexico between 1942 and 1964, I believe it was terminated, the Bracero program, which brought guest workers into the United States. Something along the lines of like 4.6 million contracts were signed. So it could be the same person, but that's a huge amount of people. A lot of Mexican Americans today actually can trace their family tree back to a guest worker that came in these years. Now, the Central American countries, not all of them, but some of them were kind of wrapped up in this anti-communism Cold War logic that Mexico was totally exempt from. And so we have a different history geopolitically with those countries that then influences like how the immigration paths have been forged by Central Americans. But I think it is worth pointing out that the demographics of immigration to the United States more generally after the 1970s and 1980s did in fact change and became many more people from Latin America and Southeast Asia started to come to the United States than ever before proportionally, which is not to justify, well, now we've got to, you know, ramp up immigration policing in every way. Just to say that there was a correlation between these changing demographics of immigration and this heightened sense that the border is the main way of understanding that, which I don't think it is. But that's, I think, the logic behind it.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is, I mean, you've got people who say, oh, we need to keep everybody and everything out. Well, yeah, maybe you want to keep, for some reason, potential workers out, or you want to keep criminals and drug dealers out. You also want the flow of tourism. You want the flow of workers that do have visas. You probably really want the flow of unauthorized workers as well, because you need them to work in your industries. Goods and services have to go both ways. So there's, like, you know, to what extent are these walls, what are they? Are they entirely scapegoating, political posturing, ways for elected officials to influence people? Like, how do you understand them?
Well, I mean, this is a book about construction projects. And so the way I think about the contemporary barrier infrastructure on the U.S.-Mexico border is by pointing out something that I think is really misunderstood among a lot of people, and that is, over the past 20, 25 years, there have actually been two gigantic building projects on the U.S.-Mexico border. One has been barriers, fences, vehicle barriers, physical impediments to crossing. And the other that is just as important, just as expensive, even more elaborate, I would argue, is the construction of more and more and bigger and more efficient ports of entry.
Right.
That connect the United States to Mexico. So going back to your earlier question about the dams that go across the river, those are great PR events because presidents could stand on top of the dams and shake hands and cut ribbons, be like, look at us, we're so connected. Less fanfare has been attached to the seemingly more banal projects of just building highways and building new spurs that like highway spurs that connect to different ports of entry and lane expansions and these types of things that both countries invested billions of dollars in the wake of the free trade agreement in 1994 to accommodate all this trade. So isn't that interesting? You have two big building projects. One building project is designed to say, don't cross. That's the barriers. And the other building project is designed to say, not just cross, but cross as fast and efficiently as you possibly can. And there is an internal incoherence and inconsistency in that. And the way to understand it, I think, is that those roads and those highways and those ports were designed to increase the speed with which commodities could cross the border. Echoes of the 19th century when Americans were, you know, at like owned half of northern Mexico. And then the barriers that say no, certain people cannot cross.
Has the expansion of this infrastructure at the ports of entry, all these extra roads and bridges and so on, facilitated the flow of people anyway?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's not only facilitated the flow of people, it's facilitated the flow of contraband as well. I mean, people have this idea that if you wanted to smuggle something across the border, you should do it at like the most remote place in the middle of nowhere. But, you know, that's hard to do because there's no roads out there for the most part, on either the Mexican side or the U.S. side. The best place, you know, the experts seem to agree, and by experts, I mean everyone from scholars to the Border Patrol themselves and CBP themselves, is the best place to smuggle something across is right through the port of entry, precisely because there is so much traffic that's going across. And the way that the people in CBP, the Customs and Border Protection, talk about it, they talk about this tension between interdiction and facilitation. Interdiction of contraband, facilitation of legal commodities. But all contraband is illegal commodities. But they function in terms of the market in the exact same way. So why wouldn't they use the same exact infrastructure that was built for legal markets, which is exactly what they do?
And so basically all they have to do is hide stuff in trucks or pay people off.
Yeah, pretty much, because there's so much traffic. I mean, the technology has gotten way better, but there is so much traffic that it is impossible today, just as it was impossible back in Operation Intercept in 1969, to actually physically inspect everybody. We're talking about 500,000 legal crossings every single day.
Right.
I mean, that is amazing. And I don't think people realize
that. In both directions?
That's just...
Northward?
That is... How do they measure that? That's a good question. I think it's just northward.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of that's back and forth.
Yeah. So what you have is this on the border now is this weird thing. You've got incredible amounts of traffic going across the U.S.-Mexican border. You've also got these giant walls, which people are punching holes in with tools that they could buy at the hardware store. You've got tunnels, which are completely secretive and unregulated. You've got these detention centers, which are completely cut off from the view of the public, including many of our elected officials most of the time. And so there's the whole question of what is seen, what is unseen, what's really going on. Children in cages, people dying horrible deaths from illnesses because they're not given medical attention. And so, I mean, I can't help but see it as this gigantic mess full of political posturing, but this illusion of control and this illusion of, you know, being essentially a fortress, you know, and the United States is like on a mountain looking down to the lands outside of Fort America it's not real.
No, it's not. And I think that if there was one really important takeaway I would encourage people to hold in their minds is to understand the border, you have to understand it holistically. You have to understand the very complex and very broad context that went into creating it and sustaining it. And that's hard to do. It doesn't fit into a soundbite. It doesn't fit into an easy answer. But it's the only way of understanding the border is as this very complex point of interaction between two very complex countries. And to give you an example, speaking to your point, I went with a colleague of mine at UT and a group of grad students down to the border in Laredo a few years ago. And my colleague's grad students were studying private detention centers in Texas. And I was, of course, studying the border. And so she was able to set up a visit to a detention center, not a private one, a public. You can't get into the private ones, obviously, unless you have a number of a specific person you're going to go see. And I organized a line tour with the Border Patrol in Laredo. And we go and meet the Border Patrol first. And they show us their horses, and they wear cowboy hats, and it's all very Texan. And they show us their, like, fan boats, you know, these, like, really loud boats that they use to patrol the Rio Grande through there. And it was a big show of stuff, like cool technology and very photogenic types of presentation of, like, the work that they were doing down there. What they refused to show us, of course, was the actual holding facilities where people were actually detained. And so we had to put those two things together in the context of this field trip with grad students, because you were going to get a totally different perspective if you were in a detention center than you were if you were out there with the horses and the fan boats and that sort of thing. And I think that, you know, that to me is a perfect example of what you're talking about. It's like you can't just look at one part of the border and think that that's what the border is or what the border means. You have to think holistically.
How do you envision a more rational and holistic border policy? I mean, what would it take to do that? What would have to change?
I think certainly attitudes in the United States, there's no question about that. And the past 2 years have been, you know, exceptionally bad in that regard. Although, you know, I often say in my classes, I don't talk about the current administration, and I certainly don't teach from the headlines. Precisely because this administration is just kind of cribbing from 20, 30 years of border policy that's already been in place. You know, so if we do the history properly, we don't really need to tear things from the headlines. We can understand the genealogy of that, you know, through looking at the past.
Which is a lot of just almost like knee-jerk racism, anti-immigrant sentiment, which has its roots in the 18th century.
Yeah, I mean, it goes, yeah, depending on how you trace it, you can trace it back quite a ways. So I think that there's definitely an attitude problem in the United States. But I think that it's also important to think about Mexican problems as well. I mean, getting back to this question of militarization, another point I always try to make, aside from pointing out this big deployment in the 1910s, is that the border is, in fact, militarized today. But it's militarized on the Mexican side. Because unlike in the United States, where it's illegal to use the armed forces as a domestic police force, it's not in Mexico. And since the most recent drug war started and the big deployments of the Fox and Calderon administrations of the Mexican military to fight Mexican citizens, basically in combat formation, we've seen thousands of human rights violations, complaints, we've seen a lot of abuses that come out of that, which is a fundamentally undemocratic way of enforcing law and order. And the United States is implicated in that just as much as the Mexican government is implicated in that.
And we have human rights abuses on our own
side. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And so again, you know, we get back to this question of like, well, okay, if we want to come up with a remedy for all the different kinds of problems that are attached to the U.S.-Mexico border, part of what that's going to entail is we're going to have to learn a lot about Mexico. We're going to have to actually take seriously our southern neighbor and the complexities of its society and its government and stop thinking about it as just this kind of this void from which smugglers come and unauthorized people come, etc. It's going to require, in order to change that American attitude or those bad American attitudes, it's going to require actually learning something about Mexico.
And seeing what our own role is
exactly
in this whether it be we need an infinite flow of underpaid labor or we're using a whole lot of drugs.
Exactly. And I would also point out, you know, going back to this big transformation of the border economy and the expansion of these ports, et cetera, I think about one of my students who was a regular in my office hours, and I was like talking to him, and he was from Laredo. His parents were from Mexico. And every time I get one of my border students into my office, I love maps, as you can tell from the book. There's tons of maps in the book. And I always get on Google Maps and I ask him to show, like, so where are you from? How does it work? Like, just to get to know different border towns. And he was from very, very near the international divide in Laredo. And he told me in his lifetime how his neighborhood, which used to be just kind of a quiet area to grow up in, has been completely transformed by the industrial footprint of just truck traffic and garages and just all the infrastructure that comes out of the free trade agreement. So there's a border dweller. There's a border person. Has nothing to do with unauthorized immigration, has nothing to do with drugs, but whose just quality of life in these border towns has been interrupted and transformed by the fact that, you know, so many people who make these big policies, they think about border towns as just like essentially just glorified ports of entry and not places where people are living and making their lives. Nobody wants to be surrounded by 18-wheelers, you know, passing by their front doorstep all day, every day.
Do you see signs of the U.S. learning more about Mexico and other signs that we may eventually move toward a more kind of rational border infrastructure and rational border policy? I mean, we haven't even talked that much about the ecological things, but I am so worried about, you know, even migrating animals not being able to cross as they've always done, because for animals, borders are completely artificial.
Yeah, I wish I had an optimistic takeaway for the listeners. I don't see very many signs of that. One of the reasons I wrote the book, though, is to remind people of a time and a place when the border was not this huge infrastructure zone, that was not as overbuilt as it is today. And I think that, to my mind at least, like one way of moving toward positive change and toward bilateral fusion and mutual understanding is by recognizing that it doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be this big construction zone that it has turned into.
You're going to be doing an event on Saturday, the 21st of December at 5:30 at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. It's part of their Critical Conversations series, and it's called Mapping. And you will be talking to historian Eric Paramond and the artist Scott Johnson, who also has an installation there. Tell us a little bit more about this event.
Well, I only know Eric via email. He wrote this great book about cattle ranching in northern Mexico. And Scott has an installation there at the CCA that I walked through last month, and it's brilliant. And talking to Scott, the way we've thought about it is there's not going to be a moderator. There's not going to be any pre-scripted questions. We're just going to sit around and have a conversation about mapping. And I think we're all coming at that question and that set of interests from totally different points of view, but complementary points of view. And so I can't wait. I think it's going to be a great time. Of course, we'll take audience questions and have a broader conversation with the folks who end up showing up. But I'm really excited about it.
CJ Alvarez is professor of Mexican American and Latino-Latina Studies at the University of Texas in Austin. And he is spending the year here at the School for Advanced Research. You're working on a book, which maybe we'll talk about some other year. And he's author of the book, Borderland, Border Water, A History of Construction on the U.S.-Mexico Divide. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
That's our program today, and we want to thank our sponsors, the Lenzig Performing Arts Center, the Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation, the Southwest Care Center, the Lannan Foundation, and the Santa Fe Institute. Thanks so much for making this program possible. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the Santa Fe Institute, a world-renowned research hub offering free online courses in the science of complex systems. Check out their community lecture series and summer science festival in Santa Fe. More at santafe.edu. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.